I set a lot of store by nature and even dry sticks of wood. These sticks are a form of energy. They are no different than oil and gas, so we shouldn't use them recklessly. As I say, I don't make fire when I camp out unless I really have to. Most of the time, I don't need to. And when I do, I make a small one. But in the Lut Desert and in the Shahdad Desert, temperatures fluctuate a lot. I remember coming here 3 years ago. One night, winter was about to come to an end. I mean, like 2 or 3 days to the end of the season, 3 years ago. That night, right here in the Lut Desert, the temperature plunged to -1 degrees. Here's the thing. In the day, at midday I mean, I had traveled deeper into this area and experienced temperatures as high as 43 degrees. That's a huge difference in one single day. It was all very strange to me. But well, that's what deserts are like. It's typical of them. It can get really cold during the night, especially during fall and winter. Therefore, you have to have proper clothes to wear, and if you manage to find a few sticks, you can keep yourself warm and enjoy yourself sitting around a campfire.
Congratulations to everyone on the occasion of 17th of Rabiul Awwal, the birth anniversary of the Prophet of Islam, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Today is in fact a day of double celebration. We also celebrate the birth anniversary of the sixth infallible successor of the Holy Prophet of Islam, Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace be upon him. Congratulations to all of our listeners throughout the world on this very auspicious occasion.
In the limelight.
It is time for the United Nations to see realities on the ground and recognize the just demands of the Yemeni people instead of wrongly backing the Aden-based rebels and refusing to call for immediate end of the Saudi-UAE aggression. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kayhan International staff writer. This article is published under the heading Time for UN to Rectify Its Misconstrued Yemen Policy. Stay tuned for more. The sheer numbers that assembled on the main square of Sana'a and flowed like a roaring sea of human beings in adjoining streets for several kilometers recently to hear the speech of their beloved leader as part of celebrations for the birth anniversary of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, was yet another proof of the popularity of the legitimate government of Yemen, which has been burdened with an unwanted war by Saudi Arabia and the UAE on the orders of the US and the Israeli regime. The massive rally, which reverberated with cries of God's Majesty, Allahu Akbar, and Salawat, or blessings upon Prophet and his progeny, while hearing the speech of the leader of the Ansarullah movement, pledged support for Yemen's independence and territorial integrity by denouncing the crimes of the invaders and their local clients, as well as the U.S. Zionist sedition against Islamic unity. No such public gathering was held in Aden or any southern Yemeni town or city where the people feel they are being held hostage by the Saudis and the Emiratis, who are using them as cannon fodder in their military aggression against their northern compatriots. As a matter of fact, the hearts of the people of Yemen are with Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi, who, as a descendant of Prophet Muhammad, coupled with his patriotism and iron resolve against the invaders, commands respect. He rightly remarked in his speech that the people of Yemen are waging a holy jihad for the sake of God that will never be compromised in defense of freedom and independence of the nation. He added, "We are religiously obliged to confront the aggression with the firmness until the Saudi siege is lifted and the aggression and occupation ends." Sayyid al-Houthi, while denouncing the Arab regimes which have betrayed their cause by ganging up with the illegal Zionist entity called Israel, made it clear that the people of Yemen are united in their support for the oppressed Palestinian people and the true representatives, the Islamic liberation movements. He said, "The resistance in Yemen also fully backs Lebanon's legendary anti-terrorist movement, the Hezbollah, and will never cease efforts for the eventual liberation of Islam's former Qibla, the sacred Al-Aqsa Mosque in Beit al-Muqaddas." According to reports, these inspiring words from a popular leader as Yemeni forces close in on oil-rich Ma'reb, where mercenaries of the fugitive from justice, Mansour Hadi, are on their last leg, have been welcomed by the people of southern Yemen. They feel that as Muslims, they ought to adhere to the path of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, and strive towards establishing a united and independent Yemen that is free of the hegemony of the Saudis, who have no right to interfere in their affairs, let alone bomb the towns and cities to kill tens of thousands of people and destroy the infrastructure. It is time for the United Nations to see realities on the ground and recognize the just demands of the Yemeni people, instead of wrongly backing the Aden-based rebels and refusing to call for immediate end of the Saudi-UAE aggression.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Algeria recently recalled its ambassador to Paris following insulting remarks by French President Emmanuel Macron that disparaged the history of Algeria and its state institutions. The Algerian president has responded to the outburst by Macron and demanded France's total respect for his country. Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to another edition of Africa Today, a program which gives an alternative view on events taking place in Africa. This week's edition is focusing on the ongoing tensions between France and Algeria following insulting remarks by French president against the North African country. In the second segment of our program, we'll talk about how the United States Military Command for Africa is being used by Washington to loot the continent's natural resources in the name of fighting terrorism. Stay with us till the end of the show and send us your comments.
Algeria rejects interference by France. Tensions between France and Algeria have continued to rise following remarks by French President Emmanuel Macron on the North African country's colonial past. Macron reportedly argued that the official history of Algeria has been rewritten not based on truth, but based on hatred against France. He also went on to question if there was an Algerian nation before colonization.
Now, in an interview, the Algerian foreign minister responded to the insulting remarks by Macron.
What was said about Algeria? Algeria had the opportunity to respond to it. We reject any interference in our domestic affairs. We don't accept value judgments on the formation of the Algerian nation. Algerian nation is an old one, deeply rooted in history, a nation that has contributed significantly to the prosperity of the region, the Mediterranean region, that has cooperated very, very efficiently and substantially with Europe, including France. Algeria has had diplomatic relations with France as well as with a number of other European nations. So we are at ease. All what relates to history, Algeria is a nation like any other nations, and therefore we don't think that it should be subject to any questioning or any debate.
Well, for more on the France-Algeria tensions, we contacted Raouf Farah, an Algerian activist and commentator. He's also the coordinator of Youth Engaged for Algeria and a member of the pro-democracy organization Ibtikar. Welcome to our program, sir.
Thank you very much for your invitation.
Now, our first question, why is the French president adopting a confrontational policy towards Algeria at this juncture?
I think we should go beyond also the contextual analysis and interpret Macron's saying as basically what most politicians in France think about the relationship between Algeria and France. And I think Macron's really underestimated the grievances that could create it in France, but also in Algeria. And this is probably one of the reasons why we are here today to discuss that.
Thanks for that, Mr. Farah.
According to some projections, the French president is now under threat from right-wing possible presidential candidate Eric Zemmour. Macron's re-election strategy appears to try to win far-right voters by making the elections not about poverty or economic crisis, but instead about glorifying French colonialism and presenting mostly North African Muslim migrants as the enemy. And all these are linked to a strategy of Islamophobia.
The Algerian foreign minister responds here to speculation that Macron's outbursts are related to the upcoming elections in France.
There are a lot of analysis. I'm not a journalist to enter into speculative area, but I read what you read, I read what you say as journalist, and I am very much interested in understanding all the situation, and I certainly believe that all of the factors that are being mentioned by the media have certainly their role in the situation and in the crisis which was created. I'm not in a position to assess which of the relevant principles have played a stronger role than the others, but one can intellectually consider that all of them can be relevant in the motivations, but it's not up to me to determine the motivations of a particular person.
Now, do you think there is a link between the insulting remarks by Macron against Algeria and next year's elections in France?
Yes. I think there's definitely a link. The organization of presidential elections in France always brings the question of the tensious relationship between Algeria and France. But I think it's not the only factor one should take when analyzing what Macron has said. I think Macron's decision is really shows what many politicians in France think about the history of the country is in Northern Africa, and they see the adventure of colonialism as, to a certain extent, an enlightenment that brought, to a certain extent, again, civilization to the region.
In another move to protest the patronizing remarks by Macron, Algeria closed its airspace to French military planes. This will complicate military operations by France in the mineral-rich Sahel region where Paris claims is fighting terrorists. Contrary to these claims, it's believed that the French army is in the Sahel to protect the country's economic interests in a region rich in uranium, gold, oil and other minerals.
Mr. Farah, what's your take on the reaction by Algeria, including closing its airspace for the French military following the remarks by Macron?
One should know that Algeria opened its airspace to the French mission, not Barkhane, but a mission called Serval, which is the ancestor of the Barkhane operation. And since then, the Bouteflika regime from 2013 until his end in 2019 didn't really put an end to that. So I think the Algerian regime took advantage of this very tenuous situation between the two countries to take a step back on what was at that time a controversial decision. And I think after Macron saying it's pretty much normal to see that the Algerian ambassador is called back in his country.
Now, Turkey's foreign minister, Mevlut Cavusoglu, has slammed what he termed as Macron's extremely wrong and populist comments on Turkey and Algeria over colonialism. Now, Macron negatively mentioned Turkey in his anti-Algeria remarks. Is Turkey's increasing influence in many African countries worrying France?
It reflects the sort of leadership competition between Turkey and France when it comes to the Maghreb. And that's not only limits to the economic aspects, but also to the diplomatic aspects, to the geopolitical aspects of this bilateral relation between Algeria and Turkey. Here I have in mind the Libyan question, where Algeria is increasingly involved as one of the most important actors of the region. And Turkey is also pushing Algeria to be on her side on that matter. And France is having a very different position when it comes to the Libyan question. So this is just an example to show that there is clearly a competition between France and Turkey, and Macron's saying are related. Immediately related to that.
Some analysts believe what is happening between Algeria and France is inseparable from the severing of relations between Algeria and neighboring Morocco, which normalized ties with the Israeli regime and betrayed the Palestinians. Is France pressurizing Algeria on behalf of the Israeli regime due to the move by Algiers to block the regime's observer status in the African Union?
I think Algeria will continue to defend the Palestinian voice within the international fora, including the African Union, and when there will be a chance to listen an increasing impact of Israel on the continent, it will do so. One of the triggers of the tensions between Algeria and Morocco, because Algeria has also cut its diplomatic ties with Morocco, is the normalization of Morocco's relationship with Israel after the signatory of the Abraham agreements. So all these factors are interrelated. And I don't see French pushing in particular for this agenda because they know that, overwhelmingly speaking, the Algerian regime remains against anything that comes from from Israel.
The Algerian foreign minister says he is optimistic that the current crisis with France will also be resolved in the future. Let's take a listen.
We have no doubt that the current crisis will be solved in the future, at any given time in the future, bearing in mind and taking into account all the principles, all the interests of the Algerian side.
Now, our last question. Should we expect further escalation between France and Algeria in future?
A tipping point in this bilateral crisis between France and Algeria. So I don't think that it will go further deep, but the consequences of this crisis remain relatively unconsumable, in the sense that we don't know the full consequences of that. I think that it won't be limited to the military and to the recalling of the ambassador. There might be also other decisions taken, but these are, I would say, indirect consequences rather than direct decisions taken by the Algerian regime against France.
Well, thank you, Raouf Farah, Algerian activist and commentator, for your insight on the current standoff between France and Algeria. Let's now take a short break, and when we come back, we shall focus on the activities of the United States Military Command for Africa. Stay with us.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
In 2008, the United States Military Command for Africa, known as AFRICOM, was established and is currently headquartered in Germany. The formation of AFRICOM was followed by a new scramble for Africa, including plans by the U.S. to expand and strengthen its hegemony in this continent.
The U.S. claims that AFRICOM operations in Africa are about counterterrorism. However, since the establishment of this U.S. command, Africa has seen a massive increase in incidents of violence attributed to Takfiri terrorist groups. As if that is not enough, U.S. forces in Africa have killed many civilians while terrorists roam freely across the continent. An investigation by Amnesty International has revealed that the U.S. killed innocent civilians during an airstrike inside Somalia instead of hitting Al-Shabaab terrorists. Amnesty says such indiscriminate attacks in which civilians are killed or injured can constitute war crimes.
Targeting individuals who are not directly participating in active hostilities, indiscriminately attacking them and killing them, amounts to, you know, a breach of international humanitarian law, and that can amount to war crimes.
Now, to discuss more about U.S. military presence in Africa, we have contacted Tunde Osazua, a coordinator for the U.S. Out of Africa Network and a member of the Black Alliance for Peace. Thanks a lot, sir, for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Now, first question, what do you think were the secret objectives of the U.S. government when it formed its military command for Africa?
Well, the purpose of AFRICOM is to use U.S. military power to impose U.S. control of African land, resources, and labor to service the needs of U.S. multinational corporations and the wealthy in the United States. And U.S. military presence in Africa didn't begin with AFRICOM, but AFRICOM now formalizes that presence with better coordination and strategic focus for realizing the long-term geopolitical goals of U.S. imperialism in Africa, which includes beating out China and others in the battle for power and influence on the continent. Another objective is the long-standing effort to prevent the emergence of any independent African influence or force. And the war in the DRC is an illustrative example. The U.S. initially worked with Belgium to assassinate the first prime minister of the newly independent Democratic Republic of the Congo, Patrice Lumumba, because of the threat his leadership posed to U.S. and Western control of strategic raw materials in the DRC. AFRICOM brings this effort into the present day through military might.
The U.S. has fully militarized its so-called war on terror in Africa. Many security experts in Africa disagree with this approach dictated by the U.S. as it has only increased terrorism. Despite AFRICOM announcing that it's in Africa to combat terrorism, we have since seen a rapid increase of terrorism. What could be the reason behind this?
AFRICOM isn't in Africa to fight terrorism, and the U.S. military presence is a destabilizing presence. Terrorism is actually a useful pretext for the U.S. to assert its power. In that sense, AFRICOM has been a success. The United States has vastly expanded its power and influence on the continent through AFRICOM as it vies for full-spectrum global dominance in the competition with folks like China and Russia. If the goal is to fight and end terrorism, AFRICOM is a woeful failure, as you've shared. The number of incidents of violence attributed to terrorist organizations have increased fivefold since AFRICOM was established 13 years ago. The ending terrorism is not the goal. Terrorism is a byproduct of imperialism, and claims of fighting against it are used for public relations purposes. Ending terrorism and liberating Africa from the clutches of U.S. imperialism means shutting down AFRICOM and removing all U.S. forces from the continent and the world.
Many innocent civilians, including women and children, have been killed during U.S. airstrikes in Somalia. AFRICOM arrogantly stated that it had not paid any compensation in Somalia for civilian casualties it had acknowledged since 2017.
Now, civilians have borne the brunt of AFRICOM operations in Africa, especially in countries such as Somalia, where the U.S. refuses to compensate the victims. Clearly, AFRICOM does not value the lives of African people. What's your take on this?
The lives of millions of African people are simply bargaining chips that are played by the United States in the new scramble of Africa, which is similar to what took place in the 1880s when the colonial powers fought over which of them would dominate which parts of the resource-rich continent. In Somalia specifically, AFRICOM has caused the murder of thousands and the displacement of hundreds of thousands of people. For AFRICOM, what matters more than black or African lives is what Vice Admiral Robert Mueller, former AFRICOM deputy, admitted is protecting the free flow of natural resources from Africa to the global market. The U.S. has also used the framework of enemy combatants to decide that a victim is an enemy without having to provide any proof. This allows them to ignore the suffering of countless civilian victims and their quest for compensation, all in pursuit of U.S. interests.
Now, Mali and Guinea are two mineral-rich West African countries that saw military takeovers this year. The coup leaders in both countries claimed that they want to put an end to corruption and human rights abuses. But the military officers who led the coups in Mali and Guinea had close links to the United States and France. And this has raised suspicions about other motives behind these military takeovers.
In 2018, thousands of people in Ghana rallied in their capital, Accra, to protest a deal that would have given the United States military an expanded role in the country. A politician from Ghana speaks here during a protest march against U.S. military presence in his country.
if you allow for a permanent U.S. military presence in our country. We have seen where everywhere there has been permanent U.S. military presence, what it has attracted. It has attracted terrorism. It has attracted destabilization. And we don't want Ghana to be destabilized. We are also saying that this agreement is lopsided, it's one-sided. There's nothing in it for Ghana apart from the dangers.
Following the protests, the president of Ghana, Nana Akufo-Addo, categorically rejected claims that the United States will set up a military base in the country.
Let me state with the clearest affirmation that Ghana has not offered a military base and will not offer a military base to the United States of America.
Now, clearly, many people in Africa are opposed to the presence of U.S. forces in this continent. Now, will all the leaders listen to the people and demand complete withdrawal of U.S. forces from Africa?
While imperialism is a global system that requires the enforcement of certain conditions, and that's exactly why autocratic leaders are supported by the West and Western imperialist projects. These governments are the neocolonial political cover for the West's control of the land, labor, and markets of the colonized. So though many people in Africa are opposed to the presence of U.S. forces in their countries, a mass or a popular movement is needed to demilitarize and depose imperialism and militarism on the continent. And that really requires the construction of a mass-based geostrategic vision that prioritizes the removal of AFRICOM and other European military projects. That's why the demands of the U.S. Out of Africa campaign include the withdrawal of U.S. forces from Africa, the demilitarization of the African continent, and the closure of U.S. bases throughout the world. And that's crucial in this effort.
Well, there you have it. A mass movement is needed to eject U.S.-led imperialist forces in Africa. Thanks a lot, Mr. Tunde Osazua, for your insight. Well, that's it for this week's edition of Africa Today. God bless you all.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
The 2022 budget for the U.S. Defense Department adds an extra $10 billion on top of the already colossal $715 billion that the Pentagon requested, according to a version of the bill that Senate Appropriations Committee unveiled. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Sharon Zhang, journalist. This article is published under the heading, U.S. Senate quietly adds $10 billion to Pentagon budget while blocking climate action. Stay tuned for more. The 2022 budget for the U.S. Defense Department adds an extra $10 billion on top of the already colossal $715 billion that the Pentagon requested, according to a version of the bill that Senate Appropriations Committee Chair Patrick Leahy unveiled recently. With amendments and other funding, this brings the total of 2022 appropriations for the Pentagon and defense-related spending to a whopping $778 billion, 5% more than the amount that was appropriated for the 2021 fiscal year. Last month, the House passed a $768 billion budget for defense. The $10 billion tacked onto the bill with little fanfare from lawmakers or the media. But even just the relatively small amount added to the defense budget is a significant amount in the other context. Over 10 years, the addition would total to $100 billion, the same amount of funding for vital climate programs that Senator Kyrsten Sinema wants to cut from Build Back Better Act, or about two-thirds of the cost of the climate program that deficit hawk Senator Joe Manchin also wants to cut. Though the defense budget is already unfathomably large, Republicans aren't satisfied with the Pentagon's budget growth. Roll call reports. Republicans like Minority Leader Mitch McConnell have asked for equal increases to defense and non-defense spending, and with increases to programs like child care and preventing violence against women, the Republicans say that the increase to the defense budget should be closer to the 14% that they say has increased in the non-defense spending. This is a somewhat absurd request considering the huge amount of money already being added to the defense budget annually, especially in a year when the country purportedly pulled out of its longest war. Last year, Congress authorized about $740 billion for the Pentagon, meaning that this year's additions alone would total about $38 billion if passed into law. If the $38 billion were locked in for the next decade, it would total about 10% of the proposed spending for the reconciliation bill, just in increases to the defense budget. While the reconciliation bill, which would provide funding to mitigate the climate crisis and support middle and lower class families in the U.S., has been a subject of bitter debate over the past month, the defense budget, which helps fund defense contractor profits, typically enjoys bipartisan support. Sinema and Manchin, for instance, have complained repeatedly about the reconciliation bill's price tag, totaling $3.5 trillion over 10 years and completely offset by taxes on corporations and the wealthy amongst their proposals. But they have been quiet about the defense budget, which would cost more than double what the reconciliation bill would cost if it were extrapolated over 10 years. Further, over the past decade, Manchin has approved $9.1 trillion for the defense budget, most of which goes towards the Pentagon, an agency that has never passed an audit. The conservative Democrats' double standard on spending also works toward their apparent quest to block any legislation to mitigate the climate crisis. Manchin and Sinema are fighting hard on behalf of fossil fuel lobbies to cut climate portions of the reconciliation bill, which advocates say is the Democrats' last chance of passing meaningful climate legislation before the 2022 midterms. Meanwhile, Sinema and Manchin remain supportive of spending for the Pentagon. which emits a huge amount of greenhouse gases. A study in 2019 showed that, annually, carbon emissions from the military-industrial complex in the U.S. averages to about the amount of emissions put out by the Netherlands every year.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
A specter is haunting America. The specter of Striketober. Upwards of 100,000 workers across the U.S. are either currently on strike or potentially just weeks away from it, amid a historic wave of labor actions that's taken the country by storm. 35,000 nurses and healthcare workers have voted to authorize a strike against healthcare giant Kaiser Permanente. 60,000 Hollywood crew members seem headed for a strike amid widespread rank-and-file disapproval of a deal negotiated by union management. And thousands of workers elsewhere have already walked off.
Last week, 10,000 UAW members in warehouse and production jobs at John Deere started currently what is the biggest strike happening in the country. We have 2,000 TWA nurses in Buffalo and 1,400 Kellogg workers. They're also out on strike. About 1,000 mine workers in Alabama have been on strike at Warrior Met Coal since this past April.
These are just some of over a dozen labor actions brewing across the country. As executives have seen profits soar amid the COVID-19 pandemic, workers are insisting on their own piece of the pie. And with supply chain issues plaguing distribution and now hiring signs popping up left and right, they're wielding historic leverage to secure the raises and benefits they say management has been withholding for too long.
There is a tight labor market. Workers are fed up with being mistreated. We have, you know, the most pro-union president ever, potentially even more than FDR. We have a union leader at the Department of Labor who is heading the Department of Labor. Positive union sentiment in polls are the highest it's been in a very long time. Labor has a lot of leverage, and this critical moment is not going to last forever.
With the wind at their backs, many workers say it's time to press their advantage and lock in the wage increases and workplace improvements that have been steadily eroded by decades of neoliberal governance and attacks on organized labor. And with no real sense for just how long this window of opportunity will last, they say it's time to strike while the iron is hot. Wyatt Reed, Washington.
Six years have passed since Iran and several states, namely the U.S., China, Russia, Britain, France, and Germany, put their signatures to a deal under which Tehran agreed to limit some of its nuclear activities in exchange for sanctions relief. But in 2018, the situation reached a deadlock when former U.S. President Donald Trump backed out of the deal. Not only that, but he also brought back the sanctions despite Iran's display of full compliance. Tehran waited for 1 year before finally cutting back on some of its commitments under the deal. Later on, with the administration of Joe Biden sweeping into power and the White House's declared willingness to return to the negotiating table, Tehran and the remaining signatories went back to the Austrian capital with an agenda to revive the landmark accord. Initially, some progress was made, but long-running issues remain unresolved to this day. In the meantime, the U.S. continues to keep the sanctions in place as a tool of pressure against Iran. Now, with the possibility of a renewed push for the revival of the deal, Tehran says it will not settle for anything less than results that would safeguard the rights of its people.
Iran is a country of dialogue and negotiation. But a negotiation that guarantees the rights of Iranian people and forces all parties to return to their commitments.
Iran has been sickened to one point.
but Washington was the party to violate the deal and should therefore be the party to take the first step by returning to full compliance. Tehran says it will start resuming its commitment only after the complete removal of all U.S. sanctions in a verifiable manner. Action and not words. That's what Iran is demanding. It also says the European partners likewise need to put aside their empty promises and get back to action.
It was the inaction of the European states that emboldened Trump to withdraw from all agreements and violate JCPOA and Resolution 2231. That happened because the European capitals all acted as only passive observers. We are expecting that all sides come to Vienna with the full understanding that there is no shying away from their commitments, which should be fully implemented under the accord.
Iran is seeking reassurances from the European signatories that such violations would never happen again. It says any renegotiation of the terms of the deal is out of question. The administration of President Ebrahim Raisi is reviewing the details of the previous six rounds of discussions held in Vienna. Now, with speculations on the possible resumption of talks in the coming days and Tehran's firm stance, one can only speculate about how the other parties will fare up.
Food experts in Britain have been advising shoppers to buy Christmas dinner months in advance, or they might go without, leading to a surge in sales. Demand for turkey has gone up 400% in recent days, and even toy shops are warning their shelves might be empty soon.
With the pandemic easing, Brexit is back in the news, with shortages of food, fuel and labour taking their toll. And this is bad news for the Conservatives, who promised to get Brexit done.
Under pressure, the government has now been forced to relax immigration rules and start issuing emergency six-month visas for thousands of butchers, poultry workers and HGV drivers to save Christmas and prevent 100,000 animals from being culled. Nonetheless, Prime Minister Boris Johnson insists there is no supply chain crisis, calling the current situation a symptom of an economy in revival.
I hate to be rude about politicians, but I have to say the Prime Minister in this case does appear to be somewhat deluded. Of course, the United Kingdom economy does have some serious supply chain issues. Mind you, so does much of the rest of the world. You only have to look at the issues relating to shipping and such like. Britain has made itself in a more difficult position by adding the phenomenon that is Brexit, which has had added further complications and costs and reduction in the workforce coming from the largest trading bloc in the world, coming into the United Kingdom, and the UK economy is suffering because of it.
For decades, EU nationals have done labour-intensive work on British farms. Labour farmers say British workers just won't do. And the fact is it will take years to train enough Brits to drive heavy goods vehicles. So it might not just be a winter of discontent lying ahead for Britain, but years of adjustment. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The Islamic Republic of Iran's Air Force has launched massive maneuvers in different locations across the country, including Isfahan, Bushehr, Bandar Abbas, Dizful, and Tabriz. The main operational phase of the large-scale drills, codenamed Fadaiyan Harim Velayat 10, began on Thursday with the participation of manned aircraft and drones. In the first phase of the military drill, aerial targets were shot at different speed and heights. Targets were hit on the ground under different conditions with the use of homemade upgraded heavy and semi-heavy bombs. During this military drill, different types of laser and radar missiles, as well as types of rockets and bombs made by young Iranian specialists, have been used. This is the first time that all the air bases of the Army of the Islamic Republic of Iran are jointly taking part in the military maneuvers, all in their own cities, but being commanded and controlled from the main command center in Tehran.
We used to hold military exercises in one particular location, but this military drill is being conducted at different locations across the country, and they're being commanded and controlled from the command center in Tehran. All the developments can be seen online by commanders at the headquarters, and so far all the operations have been carried out successfully.
tens of different types of fighter jets, bombers, cargo planes, reconnaissance planes, and drones have taken part in the military drill. Moreover, Camon 12 drone has successfully destroyed specific targets using smart bombs. At the same time, Karar drones, which have been equipped with 500-pound bombs and rockets, have been able to precisely hit the planned targets. Meanwhile, the manned aircraft of the Air Force of the Army, with the use of the most modern electronic war techniques, disrupted anti-air defense systems of the enemy, preparing the ground for drones to carry out their operations.
This is the first time that such military drill is being conducted all across the country. The main feature of this maneuver is a concentrated command for non-concentrated operations. All the missiles, rockets, and bombs which are being used in this military drill have been produced by Iranian specialists. We have used precision-guided Qased and Yasin bombs. Moreover, we have used our combat drones like Camon 12, which is able to strike its target from a distance of 10 to 15 kilometers.
This massive maneuver is aimed at using an integrated command and control network and supporting operational and intelligence systems in the integrated network of the Army of the Islamic Republic of Iran. In the drill, technology-based and digitalized equipment, weaponry, and systems have been used.
This military exercise shows that the Air Force of the Army is well prepared to protect the country's territorial integrity and has full control over the airspace of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
Winter is coming, and from the looks of things, it will be a long, harsh, and very cold one. But at the same time, the world is in the midst of an unprecedented energy crisis with dire economic, social, and political ramifications. Brent crude has surged to a five-year high of over $80 per barrel, while gas prices are up over 500% year on year. The International Energy Agency says the global energy crunch is expected to boost oil demand by about 500,000 barrels a day. Analysts say the energy crisis is rooted in soaring demand as the economic recovery from the coronavirus pandemic takes hold, and the production level has simply failed to keep up with demand. However, some immediate measures could easily resolve this crisis. One such fix would be the removal of U.S. sanctions on Iran, which enjoys one of the largest hydrocarbon reserves in the world. The flow of Iranian oil into the global market, for example, would be vital in easing the crisis.
Until a couple of months ago, it was not very important for the world that Iran is under sanctions because supply exceeded demand. But the current trends in the global market may put pressure on consumer countries, Europeans and countries like India and China or U.S. allies to push Washington to lift sanctions.
Iran has repeatedly underlined its ability to swiftly increase its crude production to help alleviate the global shortage. Its oil minister recently said people in the United States and some European countries are paying the price for their leaders' unwise policies. Javad Oji stressed that Iran, on several occasions, displayed its goodwill to help stabilize the oil market and resolve the global energy crisis. But U.S. sanctions are standing in the way. People in Lebanon, who have been facing gasoline and diesel shortages and electricity blackouts, bear witness that ways are found where there is mutual will. Iran has recently been delivering shipments of fuel to energy-starved Lebanon, despite U.S. sanctions targeting both countries. That was achieved through the determination of both Iran and the Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah. Iran had also earlier dispatched fuel shipments all the way to Venezuela. Now, as millions of people around the globe are bracing for a hard and long winter, it's worthwhile to ask how much of the ordeal could be averted through a similar international resolve.
Fear is growing in Indian-controlled Kashmir following a series of shooting incidents across the region that killed around a dozen civilians, including four non-local workers. The fear doubled among the non-local residents after police said non-locals should reach army camps and police stations. Dhananjit Kumar has been working in Kashmir for the last 12 years.
Each year he stays here for 6 months and returns home with his hard-earned money. But this year, he's moving ahead of time.
My family back home is worried. They insisted upon my return. I have worked for so many years here, but I have never seen such chaos. The situation here has never been right, but we were never involved. This time, it's different.
Dhananjit Kumar and many like him are on the move, while many others have sought police protection till they manage a way out. Following the deadly October violence in Kashmir that resulted in more than 33 killings, which included 9 Indian Army personnel, 11 civilians and 13 pro-freedom fighters in different incidents, the administration issued an alert across the war-weary Indian-administered Kashmir. Intelligence reports warn of attacks on power projects, emergency landing strips and other government infrastructure. New Delhi has installed additional security forces across Kashmir after intelligence reports warned of more attacks.
We are doing our best to neutralize the terrorists who are behind the civilian killings. We have killed around 11 terrorists in October till now, and we'll do our best to ensure the safety and security of our people. It's not a security lapse. The targets were soft, and now we beefed up and more vigilant.
After India stripped Kashmir's autonomous status in August 2019, people of the region were promised development, prosperity and greater opportunities. However, media reports suggest the situation in the region has slipped from bad to worse due to the absence of local political activities and implementation of rules and laws without taking people of Kashmir on board. Kashmir is a dispute between India and Pakistan since the partition of Indian subcontinent in 1947. The two have fought wars over the territory and claimed the region in full, but rule it in parts.
The fresh spate of violence in Indian-administered Kashmir is seen by many as a politically motivated action. People of Kashmir urge the world community to help resolve this geopolitical dispute between India and Pakistan before they engage in war and devastate the leftover life. Shahana Bhatt, Indian-administered Kashmir.
On Tuesday, European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen greeted Polish Prime Minister Mateusz Morawiecki at the beginning of a five-hour debate in the European Parliament. The niceties didn't last long.
Don't try to divert. That's the debate right now here about the rule of law and the primacy of European law. Don't try to run away and to escape that debate.
Morawiecki insists Poland's constitution has primacy over EU law, and this is infuriating the bloc's establishment. Amongst other things, EU authorities are worried the Polish government is trampling on fundamental rights, judicial independence and freedom of the press. Morawiecki insists hypocrisy is at play when rule of law is debated.
Some member states maintain tax havens. It means that in the EU, the richest member states are making even more money. How is this part of our EU values?
Criticism towards Morawiecki kept on coming, however.
For years, you have been infecting the minds of Polish people with lies and manipulation about European rules and regulations.
The Polish Prime Minister raised a myriad of issues, ranging from the EU's energy crisis to the refugee situation, but the focus repeatedly came back to him. Analysts say the EU is in no position to preach about rule of law in the light of its treatment of minority groups in the bloc, such as refugees. The problem has become worse due to recent developments in Afghanistan.
What this is doing is this is leading to a rise in xenophobia. These refugees, these people who, as I said, are at the lowest possible ebb, are now being subject to abuse and to hate crimes.
Inside the chamber, Morawiecki was criticised over his country's treatment of refugees, but he certainly was not without his supporters. Lawmakers want the European Commission to withhold billions of euro in funding to Poland, but that could be a lengthy process. When the Commission initiates proceedings against a member state, it normally takes many years before there is a conclusion to the case. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Thousands of Muslims marched through major streets of Suleja to mark the birthday anniversary of Prophet Muhammad. For members of the Islamic movement in Nigeria, the celebration has been going on for a week because it was designated as the Unity Week by the late founder of the Iran's Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini.
We all believe that the Prophet is our Prophet.